Hello, everyone, and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Tim Phillips.
Tim.
Yes.
How was your summer vacation here on October 9th?
Oh, it was awesome. Yeah, I just relaxed. Didn't watch a lot of movies, but now I'm back watching movies, so it's good.
Well, glad to have you back, of course, and it's going to be a very interesting week. You'll find out why in a minute. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk about the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the very serious, very controversial, not a Batman movie, Joker. That's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the latest movie news from the past week, including some new trailers. We're going to talk about the first looks at Birds of Prey, speaking of Batman, Six Underground, and Richard Jewell. And then Tim will be in the spotlight, as he's going to be the first of our panelists to share his top five of 1999. We're going to...
Yes.
We're going to remember like it's 1999.
Yeah.
But first, we're going to talk about everyone's favorite topic of conversation. Trademark law.
Let's get really dry here, Adam.
Let's get really dry. Let's go so far into the weeds. But no, it's interesting because there was a story in the Hollywood Reporter, and it was about how more and more writers are coming forward to try and reclaim their intellectual property. There was a amendment to the Copyright Act in the late 1970s that was passed by the United States Congress that allowed authors, after a certain period of time, to try and reclaim their IP from the people they'd sold the rights to. This has often been used by songwriters to try and get their music back, but now it's being used by people to get the inspiration for some very popular franchises. So... Or would-be franchises. So Gary K. Wolfe is the author of the book that inspired Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Michael McDowell, who wrote the screenplay for Beetlejuice. Roderick Thorpe, who wrote the novel Nothing Lasts Forever, but people are probably more familiar with the movie version of that, which is Die Hard. even David Mamet and Stephen King are apparently threatening, and apparently that's one of the reasons why Paramount moved forward with the Pet Sematary remake is because Stephen King was rumbling about getting those rights back.
Yeah, they just rushed that through, right? Just so they can get it out there before Stephen King has the rights to it.
Yeah. I think we reviewed Pet Sematary on the show, but Lord, if I can remember, you know.
How good was it? What was it?
Right. It did not leave much of an impression. Yeah. But it does seem interesting, and I mean, the precedent has already been set because Victor Miller, who wrote the original screenplay for Friday the 13th, actually got a court to say that the rights should revert back to him last year, which is why you haven't seen any Friday the 13th movies in a while, is because it's been tied up in court proceedings as Victor Miller's trying to get the rights back, and it's in appeal right now, but I have a feeling this is one of those court cases where the judges probably defer to the original. Like, there's nothing like this. The likelihood of this going all the way up to the Supreme Court is probably unlikely.
Yeah, and yeah, I was wondering why I hadn't seen my yearly Friday the 13th movie for the last 26 years or 40 years or whatever it's been. But
it's been 10. It's not. It hasn't been that bad. It's been 10 since they did that remake, the Michael Bay produced remake. But
yeah. Well, yeah, I like that it gives power back to the writers. You know, it's their original vision. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. I would like to see less sequels of sequels and prequels of prequels. And I don't know if this might do that, or the writers might just milk it for all it's worth. I'm not sure.
Right.
But anything that creates more original content gives more power to the writers. I'm in favor of that.
It could go both ways because something like Who Framed Roger Rabbit, they tried to develop a sequel for years, and it couldn't work out. And in the case of Beetlejuice, you occasionally hear rumblings about Beetlejuice, a Beetlejuice sequel. There was like famously one that like almost went into production that was like Beetlejuice Goes Hawaiian. And then things like Predator is also part of this. And of course, try every 5 or 6 years to reboot Predator into something. Die Hard, I haven't heard anything about it in a while, but I know a couple of years, like maybe 3 or 4 years ago, they were talking about a Die Hard prequel set in the 70s where John McClane's a beat cop. So, I mean, this could, you know, very well be a premeditation on the part of the writers, as you say, to like maybe stymie the nonstop, like, you know.
Yeah, Jaws 4 or like Terminator 8 or whatever, right?
Well,
like,
Terminator 6 is coming.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's an interesting example, too, because Terminator Dark Fate, which comes out in, I want to say, November, is produced by James Cameron, who, of course, was the originator of that franchise. And so this is him sort of taking ownership back on the cusp of those rights expiring and maybe reverting back to him and his ex-wife, Gail Ann Hurd. Mm-hmm. So if this is successful, if the Terminator film is successful by James Cameron coming back on board and making a competent Terminator sequel, where does that leave everything else? And does that encourage writers to seek out their material and get their material back so that they can take it to competent studios or filmmakers so that they can further milk that IP? Mm-hmm. Or does that encourage studios maybe to play ball with the original creators a bit more, mm-hmm. and secure new deals, knowing that having the original creator on might allow them to better capitalize on the IP that they so desperately want to capitalize on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very interesting from a business perspective, but from like an artistic perspective, I think like when you think of Stephen King, he hated The Shining, right?
The Kubrick Shining.
He hated it, and it's such an awesome movie. It's one of my favorites. So it's like sometimes, you know, I'm thinking now, like, it's great to give the writers more power, but sometimes people can take those visions and be a little more creative with it, you know, or do something different. And I just wouldn't want to not see that happen, right? Not see like a creative director have like free will with a project like that. Because that wouldn't have happened if Stephen King had his way. And there were a couple other Stephen King adaptations he didn't like as well. He's very particular, you know.
Yeah. I mean, the Kubrick one stands out because, you know, the movie is so great.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Kubrick is such a distinctive talent and so precise. And, you know, nothing he does is by accident. And then Stephen King... and then years later, he sells the rights to, or he I guess maybe he does sell the rights to, like, they did a miniseries version with, I think, Steven Weber as Jack Torrance.
Okay.
Not to say Steven Weber is a bad actor, but I mean, if you're comparing actors and you have Steven Weber on the one end and Jack Nicholson on the other, and you have ABC miniseries on one hand and Stanley Kubrick movie on the other, you know, which one would you favor? And I think if it's not, if I didn't write the book, I would probably go with what's, you know, Stanley Kubrick did. But yeah, there's a minefield here that, you know, what you are capable of doing in one medium does not necessarily translate. Another great example of that is J.K. Rowling, because her involvement in... She's more directly involved in Fantastic Beasts because she's writing the screenplay for those movies.
Mm-hmm.
But those are probably lesser movies when you compare it to the Harry Potter franchise, which are also actually still incredibly reverent of the books and probably aren't a late... We're not allowed to depart too far from the books. Because my favorite of the Harry Potter movies is Prisoner of Azkaban. And that's probably because it's allowed, like, it has a very strong director in Alfonso Cuarón, who maybe had the ability to, like, let the material breathe a bit more than just follow plot point for plot point for plot point.
Right. It's not a paint by numbers. It's like he has an artistic vision, and that's.
Yeah.
And that's where you see great cinema. And I think in the past, like, Stanley Kubrick's a good example. I've read about him having hired or bought rights for these books. He's, you know, there's like for like film noir, like for The Killing, he bought the rights to this book called Clean Break.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this writer who's like an alcoholic writer came on board who wrote this hard-boiled book. And they just couldn't see eye to eye because the guy, he couldn't meet Kubrick's vision cinematically.
Right.
So Kubrick had to work with other writers who are more known for screenwriting. So, yeah, it's different, like you said, different media. So you need, you know, just because you wrote the book doesn't mean you'll know how to, it's a whole different media that you'll know how to write the blueprint for the movie, you know?
Right. Like, and I've never read Nothing Lasts Forever, but I can't imagine
it sounds different. Nothing lasts forever. Yeah.
Like, is there a scene in that book where, you know, the robbers find the body of one of their compatriots and it says on his shirt, "Now I have a machine gun, ho ho ho"? I don't. No. I don't see that. I think that's, you know, and you look at the making of Die Hard. A lot, you know, it has one of those production stories where it was very much like sort of on the spot and people used what was there and. I think like all the Die Hard movies to an extent have absorbed additional material.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think there was Die Hard with a Vengeance is based on another screenplay called Simon Says.
Mm-hmm.
And then they turned it into a Die Hard movie. And then like Die Hard, Live Free or Die Hard was based on like another book that had nothing to do with Die Hard, but they took that story and made it a Die Hard story.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, just because the what's his name? What is his name? I wrote it down. Roderick Thorpe wrote Nothing Lasts Forever. Does that mean we're going to get a new good Die Hard movie? Probably not. But I mean, would a Nothing Lasts Forever movie that hews more closely to the material be interesting?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, it just sounds funny. Roderick Thorpe, Nothing Lasts Forever. That doesn't seem like the Die Hard movies we know and love.
It sounds
right?
closer to a James Bond movie, but
yeah,
well, we'll see.
You're supposed to be a British actor, and they brought in Bruce Willis.
Yeah. Oh well. So speaking of looking for good cinema, will one of these movies be good cinema? So there were new trailers released this week for Birds of Prey, which is a spinoff of the DC comic books movies, starring Margot Robbie as Harley Quinn, who was in the Suicide Squad movie. There's Six Underground, which is the new Michael Bay movie, and it stars Ryan Reynolds. And then there's Richard Jewell, which is the new Clint Eastwood movie, and it's about the Olympic Park bombing. And the security guard who was falsely accused of being the bomber had his life ruined.
Mm-hmm.
I gotta say, I think it's a nice roundup because, like, the Richard Jewell one is obviously, like, prestige. You're obviously positioning it for awards. I'll be interested to see it because it's Clint Eastwood. It's an interesting cast.
Yeah, I'll be really interested to see that one out of the three.
Because
I remember the Olympic Park bombing in 96 in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, still in my head, I still think of Richard Jewell as, like, a guilty man.
Yeah.
Because so much of the coverage were stating, you know, he must be guilty, you know.
Right.
There's this guy, and I think the press said he had a bizarre work history, and he's working as a security guard when this plot to bomb is happening. So it's like, oh, is that coincidental? And he met the profile, according to FBI and the press, for somebody who would be seeking hero worship, you know, seeking to come across as a hero and save the day. And
he was one of these guys who couldn't meet the requirements to be a police officer or someone in a field like that. So he becomes Paul Blart Mall Cop, basically.
Yeah.
And he's put in that situation where he actually did save lives, but because of who he was and the profile and the press coverage. And it's going to be another interesting 90s tale because it sort of reminds me of I, Tonya, that, you know, how much of the real story was smothered by sensationalism in the press you know, can we like finally throw all that away to look at the story with like the real eyes and the real look at the characters as real people.
Yeah. And the trailer for Richard Jewell is very interesting. It has John Hamm and another actor, and they're playing FBI agents, and they keep trying to get Richard Jewell to like admit he knows where the bomb is or something.
Right.
It's very strange. I'm like, did this really happen? So it'll be interesting to watch, like, were the FBI in on like incriminating Richard Jewell and the press? And it'll be interesting from Clint Eastwood's standpoint too, like, how far is he going to go
right
with like because he is a Republican. He is a very prominent Republican, and a lot of the Republican talking points in the states are anti-media, you know?
Yeah.
And this is a case where the media was wrong, jumped to conclusions.
Yeah.
But how far is he going to go in his storytelling to maybe vilify the media or even vilify the FBI, which is something that Trump regime has been doing as well, right?
So I think that is the concern, but I think there's like a difference between like Trump Republican and Clint Eastwood Republican, but I mean it remains to be seen, because I don't think he's let politics kind of dictate on, you know, the other things he's done, whether that's like The Mule, like the 1517 to Paris, like no matter how you feel about those movies, I don't think there's politics that's a part of them, but I don't think they're political movies. Six Underground, which looks like the most Michael Bayist movies, which actually I would much rather have Michael Bay do this than another Transformers movie.
Yeah, I guess. I'm not really thinking about Michael Bay much, but I know a lot of people are. People have a love affair with this guy.
He has his fans. I mean, it's, you know, watching the trailer, it's like Deadpool meets Rogue Nation, because it seems like Ryan Reynolds is basically running like the Rogue Nation in the Mission Impossible movie. But you know, it's also written by the guys who wrote Deadpool, Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick.
Okay.
But having said that, it's like it plays into Michael Bay. Like it's like all these like shots, these roving shots over the landscape and military porn and
all kinds of machine guns and bullets flying, bombs dropping, and in the trailer too, Ryan Reynolds, there's this scene where he goes, whoa, you can't believe what, whoa, you know.
and
I think there were a couple little jokes in there that didn't really hit either, so I'm wondering like how much of these jokes that the screenwriters tried to put in are kind of overwhelmed by, just like you said, the military porn of Michael Bay in this.
No, it's true, but it's weird, like, because one of the script doctors on The Rock, which people widely consider Michael Bay's best film, was Aaron Sorkin. And there are moments where you can tell it's where Aaron Sorkin took a pass.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are certain, like, dialogue cues, I think. And it shows that, like, despite what Michael Bay is known for, he can work with good material. He knows good material, like good dialogue when he hears it. I mean, it's not always on display, but I think he has an ear. I think he knows like when like a scene comes together, and I think people underestimate that about him.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really like The Rock, and I forgot that he directed that. But that's going back 20 years, right? Is that in our best of 97 list we're going to do?
Right, that's right.
It's done a lot since then.
And that just leaves Birds of Prey, which I think is interesting because it's coming from a Kathy Yan, an Asian American filmmaker, and it's written by Christina Hodson. So I mean, it's gonna have a very female voice, and I felt that in the trailer. It wasn't it didn't sound or feel like any of the other sort of, even Wonder Woman, any of the movies that have been in the DC oeuvre, shall we say. So,
yeah, and it was developed by Margot Robbie, and she made a point. She wanted a female director, writer. It looks really cool. And she was saying, too, that she didn't want to just be Harley Quinn on her own, but have a team with her again. So there's a team of female actors in it as well. So.
Yeah. Well, the Birds of Prey are like a group in the comic.
Okay.
So a lot of people making jokes online. It's Harley Quinn with special guest stars, the Birds of Prey. But I mean, it is what it is. But, you know, that does make it interesting that she's like had a hands-on role in developing this too. And it'll be interesting to see how this stacks up with the Marvel Black Widow, which has also had Scarlett Johansson be very hands-on in that development.
Mm-hmm.
Although there's a big spoiler involved with Black Widow that has to do with what happens to Black Widow in Avengers Endgame, but I won't get into that there. And we're going to take a break and then come back with Tim's top five of 1999. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU. Saturated beauty within the frames of winter, backing off their
Every week, Tyler gave the rules that he and I decided.
Gentlemen, welcome to Fight Club. The first rule of Fight Club is, you do not talk about Fight Club. The second rule of Fight Club is, you do not talk about Fight Club. Third rule of Fight Club, someone yells stop, goes limp, taps out, the fight is over. Fourth rule, only two guys to a fight. Fifth rule, one fight at a time, fellas. Sixth rule, no shirts, no shoes. Seventh rule, fights will go on as long as they have to. And the eighth and final rule, if this is your first night at Fight Club, you have to fight.
And that was a clip from Fight Club. It is one of the movies that came out in 1999. I don't know if it's on Tim's list, but we're going to find out.
Unfortunately not on my list.
Okay.
Just
well,
missed
then,
the list. That if it was top 10, it might have been on my list.
That worked out then. So why don't we start with your number five? We'll go in reverse order.
Okay, reverse order. 1999. Yeah. Wow, 20 years ago.
I know.
What's going on?
Time.
I'm getting old.
Time is what's going on.
Old. It's funny. I actually saw a concert last night by the band Thresh Hermit. And it was the 20th anniversary of an album they put out, Clayton Park, 1999. So It's all going back to 99. And everyone looked the same, but they all had gray hair now. So it's fun. But for the, yeah, for, my top five, number five on my list, 1999, is Being John Malkovich.
Yes. Yeah. What makes that number five?
I would just say it was such an original and odd premise. And like, when you read it, like, I haven't seen it in a while, so I went back and I was reading, and I was like, yeah, like, the plot itself, okay, a skilled puppeteer finds a portal to John Malkovich's mind, and you just think, okay, that could be the stupidest movie ever made. You know, that could just be really, really dumb, but the script by Charlie Kaufman is just amazing. And then Spike Jonze, the way he executes a very meta movie, but makes it very funny at the same time and very human. Like, there's a lot of human emotion going on, a lot of love triangles, love relationships in there. I thought it was really cool. And John Cusack is very good as the puppeteer who's unemployed, ends up as a file clerk on the 7.5 floor.
That's right.
So he always has to bend over while he's working because his head keeps hitting the ceiling. Just odd stuff. And then John Malkovich coming in, playing himself. And actually, I think at one point he enters the portal to his own mind.
Yes.
It's just meta on top of meta, but in a cool way, you know, just in a way that you care about the characters. You can see how frustrated this poor schlub John Cusack is. And Catherine Keener was awesome in it as well. And it really was a good, really an amazing phase of her career, because shortly after that, she did The 40-Year-Old Virgin, which is another great comedy. And just it's a hilarious movie, and I'd definitely recommend it because it's so weird that you won't get it out of your head after watching it, which is something that's cool, too, with movies. There's so many movies we see nowadays. You see, oh, that was good, and then you don't think about it afterwards, whereas this one, you'll definitely think about it afterwards.
Yeah,
so.
Definitely. Yeah. And Malkovich is one of those characters where, like, he actually I can't remember the exact circumstances of the story, but he was doing a play in Toronto, but he, like, in the process, he was out one day and he kind of saved somebody's life.
He did. He was out for a cigarette.
That's
and
right.
He saved somebody.
That's right. So, I mean, it's not outside the realm of possibility that, you know, there's a door to Malkovich's head somewhere.
Yeah. He's one of those characters. Yeah.
Number four.
Number four on my list, 1999, is South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut.
Ooh, good. Interesting pick. Yeah.
Directed by Trey Parker. Of course, Parker and Stone from South Park. I thought at that point it was still fairly early in the series, and they just took the series to the next level with that movie. I just thought it was brilliant. And, it's just so funny and so irreverent, and they blame Canada, which is hilarious. Yeah, Canada's the problem because Terrence and Phillip.
Yep.
Talk about, like, PC culture. They're,
that's right.
Terrence and Phillip are these Canadian comedians who all they do is fart pretty much and laugh at their farts in these weird sort of quasi English slash Canadian accent or whatever. And in the States, you know, it's so politically correct that everything's about family values, and everyone is, there's an uproar over Terrence and Philip. What are they doing to our kids?
Right.
So that was cool that the movie had like a movie within the movie, which was the Terrence and Philip movie was opening. And just like the South Park movie just crosses so many lines, that movie crossed so many lines as well. Mm. And the relationship between Satan and Saddam Hussein,
right?
Who they have a gay relationship, I thought was really, really funny, was Saddam Hussein being way more evil than the devil.
Right.
Satan, just, you feel for Satan. There's empathy for Satan because...
Sympathy for the devil.
And it's just all over the place, and I loved it. I just thought it was hilarious, yeah.
All right, number three,
another comedy, Office Space.
Oh, yes,
directed by Mike Judge. As I've worked in many offices and for a long time at office work, it really spoke to me.
Yeah,
that film.
Yeah.
And just how he has 8 different bosses and they're all coming up to him to passive aggressively talk to him about his like TPS reports.
Right.
This one small error. Oh, you know, yeah, it's okay, but you know you made that error on the TPS report. Yeah.
Right. Oh, it's the wrong cover page. It's not even like an error in the report. It's like he put the wrong front cover on the... Yeah, it's. I think it speaks to anybody. I mean, it isn't just about office jobs, but I think any job. Mm-hmm. There's a boss who you can do everything right, but they will still nitpick.
Yeah,
and like everybody knows a Lumberg. Everybody knows. Like the two guys, the Bobs. Come in to do the firing and
it's hilarious because the lead character he just gives up. He just doesn't give a crap anymore, right? He just shuts down. He's like, and they have these consultants coming in, the two Bobs, who are evaluate everybody, interviewing everybody, see what their value is, see if they're going to keep them with the company.
Mm-hmm.
And he's at this point wearing Hawaiian shirts. He's putting his feet up on the table. They're like, they talk to management. We're keeping him. He's a straight shooter.
That's right.
We've never met anybody like him before. He's got management potential right there. And
yeah.
And it's funny because he's just totally, you know, on a vacation in the office kind of thing. He's totally shut down.
Ron Livingston is great. And Jennifer Aniston is great, too, because she works as a waitress at like one of these TGI Friday places. And her best scene is when... she's always like the manager's always on her case for wearing more flair, which is like more buttons on her like apron and things.
She has to have like 12 pieces of flair.
She has to have 12 pieces, and her boss is like, and she's like, "Look, I'm wearing the 12 pieces of flair," and the manager's like, "Well, if you want to do the bare minimum, okay." And later she just gets fed up. Like, "Look, if you want me to wear 43 pieces of flair, make the minimum 43 pieces of flair," which like gets into this whole like. We want you to express yourself, but with these very narrow guidelines. It speaks like I think no matter what job, it speaks to the very real horrors of the working world at times.
And it's funny when the one guy's commuting to work, he's as white as they come. But
his name's
Michael Bolton, and he's like, I was named him before he came out, before he was famous.
Sucking.
And everybody's like, why don't you go by Mike Bolton? He's like, no, I'm Michael Bolton.
I had it first. That's right.
And then he's in traffic, right? It just the commute's horrible, and he just starts cranking gangster rap, and it's just so funny, like this guy, like.
The gangster rap part also comes into play when they systematically destroy the copier at one point.
Oh yeah,
boy, it feels good to be a gangster.
And... Yeah, they got the baseball bats. They take it out.
Right.
it's like they're Joe Pesci in Casino or something.
Yes, it's a great movie.
Yeah. So number two on my list is The Matrix by the Wachowskis.
Yes.
Yeah. I saw it when it first came out, and I was energized by it. Saw it in the theater, and then I saw it in a friend's dorm room. So that's aging myself right there. Shortly after it came out,
mm-hmm.
And I was just so impressed by it. And the funny thing is, I see it maybe randomly every 5 years or so,
mm-hmm.
And it was such a big deal when it came out. It was all about the innovative special effects, right? Like, there was so much press about, oh, these special effects are, wow, this is cutting edge. So you think, as time goes on, you know, the movie would lose its
appeal.
It would
age, yeah.
But I actually think it gets better each time I see it. And I think it works so well as a story. Mm-hmm. As cinema, it just works so well. And the characters, you really feel for them, and you're Keanu Reeves, you know, that probably his best role for me anyway, you know.
Mm.
I think, anyway. I'd have to think more, but that, yeah. Or Point Break, I'm not sure what.
Point Break. Yeah, the world building in it is tight. It's innovative. It brings together so many different things. It brings in cyberpunk. It brings in martial arts, Eastern movies, and because like all the actors kind of did their own fights and their own stunts. That, you know, that was really a benchmark for action movies. Like, it was after that, like, if you wanted to be in an action movie, you were going to have to bolt. Like, that was like 2 years later, Matt Damon is Jason Bourne, and mm-hmm. for that, he, like, the Good Will Hunting kid has to, like, bulk up and learn right. how to fight, and
yeah,
because it's all about, like, seeing the actor, seeing their face as they throw a punch or take a punch or do whatever, and that, yeah. that goes back to The Matrix, too.
Right.
Which isn't even necessarily about the special effects, but it is about, like, the dedication that, like, the Wachowskis yeah. demanded from the actors.
Yeah. And, like, Tom Cruise takes it to next level, too. He seems to always be doing his own.
Well, I think it's... I mean, Tom Cruise was always crazy. But, but I mean, yeah, he's continually taking it to the next level. I mean, you know, with the last Mission Impossible, where he, like, does a halo jump because it's... it doesn't necessarily move the plot along, but because he has to do something crazy.
Yeah.
It's, yeah. So, I mean, I think Tom Cruise found some inspiration there, too.
Yeah, for sure. It's in his contract. Most actors, you're not supposed to do anything dangerous. In yeah. his contract, he has to
yeah.
do something life-threatening.
Yeah, I just read the script, and I'm really not in danger until page 59. That seems like an oversight. Can we get a rewrite?
Yeah.
Well, let's do number one.
Number one is Eyes Wide Shut.
By Stanley Kubrick. Speaking of Kubrick.
Yeah. And I just thought it was... I was amazed by it when I first saw it, and still am when I see it. The timing for me personally was very interesting because I had just finished reading a biography on Stanley Kubrick.
Mm-hmm.
And it was saying, oh, his next project's going to be Eyes Wide Shut. It's going to come out soon. And it took 12 years between movies because 87 yes. he did Full Metal Jacket.
That's right.
99 did Eyes Wide Shut. And in that phase, there was other projects. He was, I think at one point, he was slated to do Schindler's Ark, which ended up being Schindler's List.
Right.
And then AI, which Steven Spielberg ended up finishing as yeah. well. So Steven Spielberg did a couple of movies he was slated
That's
to do.
Right. Yeah.
But you can... It was worth the wait. I just think it's a excellent movie, and I would say I really do like the dreamlike state. I think at the time it came out, people were kind of confused by it, or there was mixed reviews. Like, why are they talking so slowly? But it's a very interesting, hypnotic, dreamlike state.
Yeah,
I think at the time it came out, there was mixed reviews about the orgy, and I think even some people said that it was boring and stuff. But I found, like, the sense of danger and mystery that Tom Cruise was in at that point. Oh, it all comes back to Tom Cruise. Yeah, that Tom Cruise was right. in, you know, with the Fidelio and, you know, the password to get to the manor and, like,
right.
what's going to happen to him? What's going to happen to this woman who tried to save him?
Right, and, like, what happened to her? And, like, there's a, like, is there, like, there's a scene where he's like trying to figure out what happened to her, and I think it's the Sidney Pollack character who's like,
yeah.
like nothing happened. It's like, what do you think is going on? yeah. And there's the mind games in it are very, very subtle because as you said, it's structured in like this sort of dreamlike way where you think he's like entering into this dangerous situation, but it's just like kinky rich people who have nothing better yeah. to do. And
Sidney Pollack's excellent.
Sidney
he's
Pollack
very
is
creepy
great, yeah.
in that movie.
Yep.
And I saw him, of course, in Tootsie. He acted in that, too. He's a good actor. He just doesn't...
Yeah.
He's obvious, he's more of a director, but he was really good in that. And creepy. And there's a lot of... Like, there's a prostitute character he meets on the street. She was really good.
Mm.
there's that weird costume shop he goes to.
Nicole Kidman is really good too. I think Nicole can't really.
Yeah, Nicole Kidman was excellent in it, and it has a great closing line to it when she says what they should do next right after all this jealousy and dreams and stuff, what they should do next.
Right.
But she was excellent. I just think it was interesting seeing it when it came out too, because a lot of Kubrick movies, they get mixed reviews when they come out, and then later on they get a following. And this was the first one I really lived through, because I'm not old enough to know like what Clockwork Orange kind of reviews it got when it came out, or you know, Doctor Strangelove. But you go back and you read, and they tend to have like mixed reviews when they come out, and then they get acclaim as they go. And I think this one's slowly building that. I know there's a lot of people who still probably don't like it as much as I do, but I think also there were some marketing problems when it came out, because everyone thought it was going to be this erotic film with Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise, who were the biggest stars at that point.
I mean, that was directly on the marketing. I remember the trailer for it, and the trailer for it is, if I remember, it's like this like twangy, like bluesy song, but it's the scene of the two of them making out in front of the mirror.
Yeah.
And it's like, and then it's just like eyes wide shut.
And
it's like, well, if that's the trailer, I can't wait to see.
Yeah, and the song, the song was "Baby Did a Bad Bad Thing"
that's
by Chris Isaac, and
it was
like, you're like, oh, this is going to be really a tawdry film or something.
That's
But you know, it's better it wasn't. It was,
it was much more about what's in your head. It was, I should revisit it. Yeah. All right, well, that's the top five of 1999, I should say, from Tim. We'll follow up next week. I think Peter is here next week, so we'll see what Peter has to say.
Okay.
All right, and then
I'm
we're
sure he'll just match all mine, because Peter and I see eye to eye.
Oh, totally. we're going to take a break and come back with a review of Joker. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
You're running from, you can't be wrong, wrong. Town to town, ooh, its tail comes around. Oh, the darkness won't wait, ooh, it's gotta hold.
Arthur, I have some bad news for you. This is the last time we'll be meeting.
You don't listen, do you? You just ask the same questions every week. How's your job? Are you having any negative thoughts? All I have are negative thoughts.
In a world where everyone thinks they could do my job, check out this guy.
When I was a little boy and told people I was going to be a comedian, everyone laughed at me. Well, no one's laughing now.
You can say that again, pal.
And that was a clip from Joker. It is the new film from Todd Phillips, and it stars Joaquin Phoenix, Zazie Beetz, Francis Conroy, Brett Cullen, Glenn Fleischler, and Robert De Niro. And it's gotten a lot of controversy, a lot of concern in the United States, you know, police officers at theaters and all that. I wish the controversy was over a better movie, though.
Yeah, this movie, I'm kind of glad you said that, but I was kind of wishing maybe you liked it, and then we'd have a real real Siskel and Ebert debate here or something.
Right.
But this, like, I wrote down... This, I just wrote Joker, flaming turd of a movie. That's all I wrote down. Man, I can't believe it was just so dismal to have to sit through that for 2 hours.
Yeah.
It was just like give me something here. Give me like some light to it or something. Like, I must say that Joaquin Phoenix, yes, he's an excellent actor. He probably did what he was meant to do in the role.
Right.
He did the method acting. He went for it. In all the limitations that were imposed on him. And it's just a horrible, dismal movie I found where there's like no light to it. You see who the influences are. And I really like Todd Phillips when he's done comedies. Like mm-hmm. The Hangover is, I think, one of the funniest movies. I really like Old School. And now he's crossing over, but he's not quite Jon Favreau right now crossing over from
Gunny. Right.
And I just thought it was way too dismal. And you can see his influences were like, and obviously as Robert De Niro in the movie.
Yeah.
His influences are Taxi Driver and King of Comedy, basically. Mm-hmm. So Joaquin, the Joker, is kind of like an amalgamation of like Travis Bickle and Rupert Pupkin.
Right.
Travis Pupkin, I guess. But,
that would have been too on the nose.
but those were like two much better movies. It's like it was such a weird movie in that he has all these 70s influences and trying to make it gritty, and then there's just nothing to it. It's just like it's just this character having like a mental breakdown for 2 hours
mm-hmm.
with no, I don't know, there's no light to it. Like at least Taxi Driver had Jodie Foster in it, you know, it had right. had something to it, you know, some light to it.
There was a redeeming characters yeah.
whereas
yeah, I think I liked it better than you, but I think it's cleverer than it thinks it is, or yeah. it's cleverer than it is, I should say. It thinks it's cleverer than it is, I guess, yeah. is what I'm trying to get at. It's from sort of reading some of the comments people post about it online, I think it's one of those movies that makes people who don't see very many movies feel like they're cinephiles,
mm-hmm.
because, ooh, it's like, ooh, that was inspired by Taxi Driver. It's like, yeah, tell me something I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's I would agree with Joaquin Phoenix. I think it is a showcase for mm-hmm. him.
Yeah.
He has wonderful physicality in it. There's like so many scenes where it's like you see his gauntness and his thinness, and there's a scene where it's like he's clearly having some sort of, I don't want to say fit, but because there's this kind of a negative connotation because the character does suffer from mental illness, but like he's clearly suffering,
mm-hmm.
Having some kind of episode after he's attacked by some hoodlums who steal his sign because he's a clown who does this, like the sign twirling and things. Mm-hmm. And he's clearly like having some sort of episode, and you see him just like hunched over, and mm-hmm. you see the spine protruding from the back, and you hear like he's clearly like got something in his hands that he's like twisting and turning, and hear the rubber, and it's like almost like nails on a chalkboard. You can just like feel his suffering, and he doesn't have to say anything at all. It's just, it's mm-hmm. there, it's pervasive. And then if that was the movie they wanted to make, okay, but there's so many things that it feels like it's trying to get at. There's bits of Anonymous, because, you know, the Joker, or the Arthur Fleck character, who, quote-unquote, becomes the Joker, ends up inspiring this movement of,
yeah.
you know, people who wear clown masks and get into civil disobedience. So yeah. there's an Anonymous aspect. There's an Antifa aspect. There's elements of, like, incel and alt-right culture. And
yeah.
But at the same time, it's like, no, he's got mental illness, and it's, like, super serious, guys. Like, he was abused. And
yeah.
And it's just like, no, it's too much. You need to, like, sort of, it's one thing to sort of hint at things and to present a complex picture, but Todd Phillips, you're throwing spaghetti at the wall and going, art! Do you see art? Yeah. That's art!
Yeah.
And it's like, well, is it?
Yeah. Yeah, no, the one, and before seeing it, like, there's a lot of speculation and talk like, okay, this is this incel or what have you.
Right.
I think the one thing that it was the class warfare thing he brings out, and then it's like really prominent at the end. Like you mm-hmm. said, everybody in the clown masks who are from the poor going up against the Waynes of the world who are mm-hmm. the rich and the elite. And it doesn't really fit with what's happened before. It's so personal to
yeah.
Joker, and then it becomes this thing, and I don't know, it's like, yeah, and then at the end it was kind of like, okay, now he's the Joker. It's like almost like it would have been better if it was just sort of like an origin third of a movie or something, you
right.
know, and then it got into him as the Joker, but it was just pretty much, it's all just origin, him just in this most dismal, depressing state for like 2 hours,
yeah,
and then you see at the end he's kind of free of it in this really crazy way, because now he's like,
it's very
a
confused
celebrity in a way.
Yeah,
you know?
It's very confused about the character, because in the comic books and the Dark Knight touches on this a lot, that Joker is an aberration amongst the criminals, in that he just does things because, as the Michael Caine, Alfred points out, like, some people just want to watch the world burn.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those people don't create a movement.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. they're not movement people.
Yeah.
And there was some of this on the TV show Gotham too, that Joker kind of creates a movement of people willing to indulge in their craziest aspects. It's like, no, that's not what the character is about. The character, even in Gotham City, which is filled with people who dress up as penguins and people who dress up as, you know, Mr. Freezes and, you know, Clay Faces and Two Faces, and all those people have a point. Like, there's a reason why they're criminals. Like, Mr. Freeze is trying to save his wife. You know, the Penguin's been mocked all his life, so he's trying to, you know, become the most powerful guy. The Riddler has issues, and Two-Face, like, has a psychological break. And the Joker is just the Joker.
Mm-hmm.
And to try and, like, cram 13 different explanations for why he does what he does, and then on top of it make a social movement, just makes no sense at all.
Mm-hmm.
And if you wanted to tell the story about how somebody goes so wrong, they just become a killer and clown face, okay. But the whole social movement aspect and inspiring others, it's very clearly based on, like, 1970s New York, 1980s New York, which was a powder keg, which was a sort of the height of urban decay.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, there was also no movement at the time. You know, people sort of suffered in the decay, and it, you know, it took a while to come out of it. And so it's just, he doesn't really seem to know what he's trying to say.
Yeah, and that's what, you know, Taxi Driver hit it on the nose in the 70s, that decay.
Yeah.
And he's taken
filmed amongst it too.
Yeah, and he's taken elements of it. Like, Joaquin Phoenix does it, I think, does a credible job, but he's trying to be like Robert De Niro. I think that's, you know, that method actor in Taxi Driver.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the film, like I said, there's no, like you said, no redeeming character. There's no Jodie Foster. Yet it's like, if you go back to Taxi Driver, he had a couple creepy friends or whatever, coworkers in the who worked as cab drivers as well. In this, he's a clown. There's these couple creepy clowns that are in it. And it just adds nothing to the film that these people, you know, it kind of shows that he's being bullied at work a little bit by this.
Yeah.
But it's just, it just doesn't add any light or dimension or anything to it. You know, it's just sort of, yeah, just a really depressing way to look at the world. And, yeah, like you said, in the 70s in New York, maybe it was depressing, but there's a lot of people who've made movies and you leave them and you feel, like, exhilarated even though it's depressing, you know, or you leave feeling like, okay, I've seen, like you said, a great work of art, not somebody just throwing crap at the wall kind of thing.
Right? Yeah, it just, like, I can live through, like, depressing. I saw Midsommar earlier this year. I can, you know, but, you know, what are you trying to tell me? And I think that's where this film falls. It's like, are you trying to tell me it's like okay to exploit people who are mentally ill and people who are abused, as long as you can like staple your message on top of them? And because I mean, the film makes a point that that Arthur Fleck, the Phoenix character, he says like, oh, I'm not here to make a political statement, and then he makes a political statement. And it's, you know, so what, you know, what are you trying to say, Todd Phillips? And I think that he's been very abrasive in terms of how people have reacted, in terms of like the critical reaction some people have had, and you know, him going off the cuff like, well, I can't make comedies anymore because of woke culture. And it's like, well, you can't really make dramas for the same reason. It's,
he's in a real bad place right now.
Right. You know, you're stuck, so it feels like you're sort of raging against the machine yourself, and you sort of latch onto the Joker as like an expression of that. And it's like, well, the Joker isn't the raging against the machine. The Joker is just a rage machine. And it just feels like it's not that there's not anything redeeming. Although, you know, maybe something like the Warriors. Like, the Warriors isn't particularly redeeming either, but I think that's another inspiration here. Although, you know, they get to the end, they get to Staten Island, and they sort of look at the sunrise, and it's kind of like, oh, we survived one more night in this squalid hellhole. There's not even that moment. And it gets to the end, and there's been this question of, I actually like the idea that maybe Thomas Wayne was an a-hole.
Yeah.
Was kind of like, you know, an amoral jerk of an a-hole, and that, you know, sort of because he's killed, and you know, him and his wife are killed in a back alley, and they leave a young son to grow up orphaned, that, you know, maybe there's a bit of a martyr complex there. But I think that I can't even remember what the point I was trying to get out going into that direction, but it's trying to enjoy, like, sort of being able to try and undermine the text while still playing into the text, too. And this is what I was trying to get at, too, is this idea that how much of this is in his head. And we find out that he has this whole relationship with a neighbor played by Zazie Beetz, and that was, like, kind of in his head, and that's kind of revealed, like, near the end of the movie, that all these, like, cool times he's had with her were in his head. And so that all we're left with is, I think, in terms of, like, the real interactions he's had with her are, like, a brief encounter they have in an elevator where they ride in the elevator together, and then a scene where he's stalking her.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
and
you can kind of see that coming, but it is, I guess, it is kind of interesting the way that's revealed.
Right.
At the same time, I guess, I'm going back, I get being kind of a film snob in a way, because I've seen Taxi Driver multiple times. Like, the whole thing with putting his fingers up to his head, that's like the end of Taxi Driver, right? It's just like, trying to be such an homage to it, but I think, like you said, it misses the point of, you know, where is this man in the culture he's in? Like, Travis Bickle, almost a political assassin, he's trying to navigate his way through, he's doing stuff randomly, and you're saying, like, the Joker's a random character.
Yeah.
You know, why does it fit so neatly in this box at the end where it's like, okay, it's a movement now?
And yeah.
I don't know. It seemed to me to be like 2 hours of my life I'll never get back in a way, you know? But I could see other people maybe liking it because of the performance by Joaquin Phoenix, but it just doesn't – I don't think it amounts to anything. Like,
no, I don't think it amounts to anything. I don't know how anyone – I mean – we shouldn't sort of limit our imagination. I'm not sure how this would inspire anyone to do anything other than to, you know, maybe go and watch Taxi Driver. But it's there's so much to it, too, that it's just like how much of it is in his head. And then we come to the end, and it's kind of like it asks the explicit question. And I found Ad Astra, which was another kind of disappointment for me, does that, too, where it's like, we can't let the subtext lie. We have to make it text. We have to make it explicit. Was this all in his head from, like, the first minute you see him at the beginning of the movie till this moment right here, 2 minutes before the credits roll? Mm-hmm. Is it all in his head? Maybe.
Oh, yeah.
And Ad Astra did that, too, where it's like, it's okay to leave stuff nebulous. It's okay to make us ask the question, like, is he imagining this?
Yeah.
But I don't need you to, you know, tilt my head over to the next frame and go, see, he is maybe imagining this. I don't need you to guide me by the hand. And I feel like there's just not enough confidence here to just sort of let the thing, because Taxi Driver also ends on a very nebulous note, too, where you're not exactly sure how much of this was in Travis Bickle's head. And it's just, you got to let us think for ourselves. The whole point of this thing is, like, kind of like, think for yourself. It's a controversial movie, but you can decide for yourself to see it. And then at the end, it's like, well, we can't really let you decide for yourself because we're blatantly walking you up to the line.
Yeah, and I think at the start there made a good point about, like, so much of the press on this film is about, okay, there's you know, there's danger, there could be shootings, there's, like, you know, this could inspire, you know,
who knows?
Lone terrorists who are going to do something. And, like I'm saying, afterwards, I just, I don't know who, like, who's this? It's not going to inspire anybody. It's just a really bad movie that's trying to say something, but doesn't really know what it's trying to say.
Yeah.
And it's just, I don't know. And for like an origin movie for a character like Joker, it kind of misses the mark, I think, because like why just make a 2-hour movie that's just leads nowhere basically about this character,
right? You
know? I think, like I said before, it'd be better if the origin part, you know, have 15 minutes of this or something, and then it leads into a movie with the Joker in present day.
I think the idea is sound. Like, can you recontextualize like a character like the Joker and try and tell something serious with that character? This is not that movie.
No.
So we'll have to leave that there. If you would like to listen to this show again, you can. You can find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com, or download it from the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday on Podbean or through your favorite podcast app at iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Find us on social media on Facebook at endcreditsradioshow or on Twitter at endcreditsradio. And Tim, where can people find you on the internet?
Flash in the Deadpan, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook.
Hmm.
Yeah, I'm right. They'll have people still have Facebook, right? I'm writing a play right now, so I'm looking for a collaboration on that. So if you're interested, flashinthedeadpan@gmail.com.
All right.
Yeah.
Intentional playwrights. Yeah. I'll be here tomorrow at 5 p.m. for News and Politics on Open Source's Guelph with Scotty Hertz. And in the meantime, on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to guelphpolitico.ca for my political stuff. Stay tuned for my great programming here on CFRU, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We'll be back next Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more end credits, and we'll see you then.